Welcome to Managing Myeloma. I'm Dr. Ajay Nuka. In today's presentation, I will discuss managing major adverse events in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma. In this video, I'll provide you with the information and tools necessary to develop strategies for managing baseline and treatment emergent renal and hepatotoxicity from therapies used in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, recognize the risk of peripheral neuropathy and cardiovascular toxicity associated with specific agents and in specific populations, identify therapies associated with infusion reactions in relapsed refractory multiple myeloma, and appropriate management strategies to mitigate these. Let's begin. Relapsed refractory multiple myeloma patients present with renal or hepatic insufficiency, either due to disease progression or due to either other predisposing conditions like diabetes, hypertension, vascular disease, and other use of nephrotoxic or hepatotoxic drugs that are more common in the advanced stage. It is of extreme importance to determine whether the toxicities are myeloma-related or the treatment-related. Understanding the etiology of this toxicity will help tailor the treatment regimens, facilitating for an uninterrupted delivery of these treatment strategies. I'll talk about the renal and hepatic dose modifications. I'll start with the IMiDs. So there are three IMiDs that are currently FDA approved. The first one is thalidomide. Thalidomide is not cleared by the kidney, so it is perfectly fine to use at appropriate dosing, even among patients who are on end-stage renal disease and hemodialysis. It's of extreme importance to realize this because majority of the patients who present with renal dysfunction upfront may need a thalidomide-based regimen where thalidomide could be used without any dose reductions. Lenalidomide, on the other hand, is partially cleared by the kidneys, which needs dose reductions. Among patients who have creatinine clearance of greater than 60 ml per minute, the full dose can be used. Among patients who have moderate renal dysfunction with clearance between 30 to 60 ml per minute, a 10 mg per day dosing is used. Among patients on hemodialysis, 5 mg once daily is the recommended dosing. Pomalidomide is also kidney friendly, does not need a huge amount of dose reductions even among patients who have creatinine clearance of less than 30 ml per minute. Among those patients on hemodialysis are the ones that require dose reduction by 25%, 3 mg once daily on 1 to 21 days every 28 days. When you look at the hepatic toxicity of the immunomodulatory agents, thalidomide or lenalidomide have not been adequately studied, but in pomalidomide, it is very friendly, requiring dose reductions. At normal hepatic function, a full dose can be used. Among patients with mild to moderate hepatic insufficiency, a 25% dose reduction is recommended at 3 mg once daily. And in patients who have severe hepatic insufficiency, a 50% dose reduction is recommended. Among the proteasome inhibitors, the bortezomib, which has been the first FDA-approved proteasome inhibitor, no toxicity, no dose reductions are recommended for renal toxicity. Even among patients who are on hemodialysis, a full dose of bortezomib can be used. Carfilzomib also is a potent proteasome inhibitor, among which I would suggest that when you're using carfilzomib, monitoring for tumor lysis syndrome is of extreme importance. So even though carfilzomib is very friendly to the kidneys, the main, when it was first approved, being a good proteasome inhibitor, it was able to give a huge amount of tumor response and subsequently resulted in tumor lysis syndrome. So my suggestion would be to hold the carfilzomib until renal function stabilizes if you're seeing any renal insufficiency and start at one dose level reduction. Among patients on hemodialysis, hold until the renal function stabilizes and start at one dose level reduction. Ixazomib, the new oral proteasome inhibitor, is also friendly to the renally. Among patients who have creatinine clearance greater than 30 ml per minute, a full dose of ixazomib can be used. Among patients who have less than 30 ml per minute or patients on hemodialysis, a 25% dose reduction is recommended. Coming to the hepatic insufficiency, bortezomib can be given at full doses among patients with normal or mild hepatic insufficiency. Among patients who have moderate to severe hepatic insufficiency, a dose reduction to be a one dose level reduction should be considered and could be escalated at a later time when at the return of baseline functions. Carfilzomib, there's no data for severe hepatic insufficiency, but certainly it can be dose reduced in mild to moderate hepatic insufficiency by 25%. Ixazomib, similarly, no dose reductions are required for normal to mild hepatic insufficiency, but certainly dose reductions are needed for patients who have moderate to severe hepatic insufficiency. Coming to the other anti-myeloma agents, including the monoclonal antibodies, these are the most friendly agents in terms of the toxicities. Elotuzumab could be given renally, does not need any renal dose reductions, could be given at full doses, even among patients on hemodialysis. Similar case with the daratumumab. We don't have data for both these agents for severe hepatic insufficiency, but no dose level reductions are required even among patients with mild to moderate hepatic insufficiency. One other drug which has gained the FDA approval was panobinostat, which is an HDAC inhibitor in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone, and we don't have data about panobinostat's usage in hemodialysis patients, but among the others with renal toxicity, it could be safely used. Cyclophosphamide requires a 50% dose, 75% dose reduction, and among patients who are on hemodialysis, we recommend a 50% dose reduction. Once you understand the dose reductions that are needed and clearly what the toxicity is related to, it is very easy to understand the treatment selection at relapse based on the treatment-related factors as well as the patient-related factors. Several factors come into account when you choose the treatment selection at relapse. Previous therapy, the regimen-related toxicity, the depth and duration of the prior response, tumor burden of the relapse, all these factor into the decision for the treatment choice at the time of relapse. Similarly, patient-related factors, as we discussed, the renal insufficiency, hepatic insufficiency, and other comorbidities certainly play a role in choosing the right regimen that is more friendly to the patient. As we had seen a common theme over the last several years, there are 6 randomized controlled trials that have shown the benefit of a triplet regimen compared to a doublet regimen over the last few years. So these 6 studies have used 2 different backbones. 2 studies have used the bortezomib and dexamethasone backbone. The other 4 studies have used the lenalidomide and dexamethasone backbones. When you're adding a third agent, you're getting the benefit, but at the same time, you got to realize that the toxicity levels are higher too. So we did a meta-analysis a few years ago, including 4 trials that have been evaluated comparing a triplet regimen to a doublet regimen, and we're able to show that the toxicity is not significantly overwhelming, but the odds ratio is 1.5 times compared to a doublet regimen in terms of a grade 3 toxicity. If you look in the slide, most of this toxicity is probably coming from one trial, which is the Panorama trial, which is skewing the forest plot to the right side. So if you look at the individual agents, the AEs of interest in the Tourmaline MM1 trial, which basically compared the triplet regimen, ixazomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone versus lenalidomide and dexamethasone, the side effect profile for this specific drug is very, very beautiful. The major side effects that you can see as a theme are the GI toxicity with diarrhea, constipation, nausea, and vomiting. And most of these are less than grade 3 toxicities. If you focus on the grade 3 toxicities, diarrhea is seen in 6% of the patients in the ixazomib lenalidomide dexamethasone arm compared to 3% in the placebo lenalidomide dexamethasone arm. This is a very good, well-tolerated agent, oral agent, does not have long-standing toxicities of peripheral neuropathy, could be mildly myelosuppressive, but these are very well tolerable. Especially when you're combining it with the lenalidomide, which has the side effect of myelosuppression, looking over the labs with a bit of vigilance is strongly recommended. Other infrequent adverse events from the Tourmaline MM1 trial include hypertension in 6% of the patients compared to 5% of the patients in the lenalidomide dexamethasone arm. Arrhythmias were common across the both arms. All the side effect profile is almost similar to what you see with placebo plus lenalidomide dexamethasone versus exacerbin lenalidomide dexamethasone. If you look at the next trial, the ASPIRE trial, compared the triplet of carfilzomib, lenalidomide dexamethasone versus lenalidomide dexamethasone in relapse refractory patients. If you look at the all-grade toxicity, dyspnea comes to be the top on the list, with almost 20% of the patients having an episode of dyspnea. And grade 3 toxicity was seen in 3% of the patients who have dyspnea in the carfilzomib lenalidomide dexamethasone arm, compared to lenalidomide dexamethasone arm having 3% of 2% dyspnea. Peripheral neuropathy rates are similar. If you look in the third row, hypertension seems to be a common theme among the patients receiving carfilzomib-based regimens. The grade 3 toxicity with hypertension is close to 5%, and this needs worth mentioning. We'll talk more about this in a minute. So acute renal failure rates and the DVT rates, all these are almost similar to what you see with the lenalidomide dexamethasone arm. The few AEs of interest that comes to mind when you speak about carfilzomib-based regimens are, number one, hypertension, number two, non-pulmonary, non-cardiac dyspnea, number three, cardiac failure. These seem to be slightly higher compared to the backbone of the lenalidomide and dexamethasone. So the main problem when you use a carfilzomib-based regimen is the schedule. You typically, the patients have to go for 6 days in a week, on 2 consecutive days for 3 consecutive weeks, and you get a week off. So that's almost 6 visits. And what CHAMPION trial tried to demonstrate is, how can we reduce the number of infusions? Can we do it on a weekly dosing instead of twice weekly dosing? So CHAMPION trial evaluated at a higher dose of carfilzomib at 70 milligrams per meter square and evaluated in 104 patients on a weekly basis. And what you see here are the adverse events that were seen in more than 20% of the patients, fatigue and nausea and diarrhea being the most common side effects with carfilzomib and dexamethasone. More importantly, if you look at the grade 3 toxicities, fatigue, hypertension, and thrombocytopenia, anemia, all the symptoms of myelosuppression, as you can see. To summarize the safety of the immunomodulatory agents, there are 3 IMiDs that we currently have approved by the FDA: thalidomide, lenalidomide, pomalidomide. The main side effects with thalidomide are neuropathy, DVT, myelosuppression, and rash. The main side effects with lenalidomide are DVT, myelosuppression, and rash. Main side effects with pomalidomide are neutropenia at higher doses and formation of DVTs. What you see commonly as a theme across the board is the formation of DVTs. It is not uncommon to see a DVT in around 6% of the myeloma patient populations receiving an IMiD. So appropriate usage of thromboprophylaxis with aspirin, or if the patient has more risk factors like a prior DVT, or using steroids or using in combination with any chemotherapeutic agents, certainly going on with a low molecular weight heparin certainly helps with the thromboprophylaxis. Among all these 3 agents, myelosuppression is least common with thalidomide. So in somebody who has poor counts, probably that would be my IMiD of choice. Patients with rash could be rechallenged with lenalidomide, should not be completely withheld of an IMiD. They should be rechallenged, but what dose reduction or recommendation that I make is changing the dexamethasone to prednisone and giving it on an alternative day rather than giving it on a weekly basis certainly helps with rash. So how do you manage these AEs for the venous thromboembolic events with the IMiD-based therapies? Basically identifying the risk factors, whether the patient is receiving a single agent lenalidomide. In such case, in the absence of any other comorbidities, in the absence of any other risk factors, the patient could be benefited with thromboprophylaxis with aspirin alone. If they have more than one risk factor, low molecular weight heparin is indicated. Other side effects like the myelosuppression could be closely watched, and growth factors could be given if the patient needs to continue the treatment uninterruptedly. And you could also take the support of IVIG or take the support of antibacterials when you're using a dexamethasone-based, high steroid-based regimens so that you prevent the PCP pneumonias. To summarize the proteasome inhibitors, the three proteasome inhibitors that we have currently are bortezomib, carfilzomib, and ixazomib. Bortezomib, the main side effect is neuropathy. You also can see thrombocytopenia or myelosuppression with bortezomib-based therapies and GI toxicities. So appropriately identifying these patients who are at high risk for the neuropathy would certainly help us to monitor closely so that we make the appropriate dose reductions or the management strategies otherwise specified for the institution. For carfilzomib, monitoring for fatigue, making appropriate dose reductions, monitoring for anemia, nausea, thrombocytopenia, which is a class effect. These are all the things that could help us to mitigate these side effects if you watch closely, so that we'll be able to deliver these treatments without any interruptions. Similarly, ixazomib, the main side effects that I can think are the rash and GI toxicity, appropriately treating these patients with antinauseants, treating them with a PPI, and appropriately treating them, monitoring for rash, and certainly can help with delivering this drug. So neuropathy, for bortezomib, the dose modifications that were recommended are going down to one dose level to 1 mg/m² on an induction setting at days 1, 4, 8, 11, if you're using the induction dosing, or going back to a weekly regimen is appropriate. So what we had seen over the last 5 years was when we moved from administering the IV bortezomib to subcutaneous administration of bortezomib, we had seen a significant decline in the grade 3 toxicities that we were used to seeing. So it's a good move, and we are seeing lesser and lesser rates of neuropathy, and appropriate monitoring certainly helps. So coming to a completely different topic, the cardiotoxicity with the proteasome inhibitors. In my opinion, the real etiology is it is a class effect with the proteasome inhibition that could lead to cardiotoxicity that could manifest as cardiac failure, uncontrolled hypertension, and sometimes dyspnea. So what was seen in the past from the Richardson trial, the APEX trial that was published way long ago, almost 10 years ago, was there was a signal of cardiac toxicity in those patients. And what we had seen in the recent years was, we all know that carfilzomib is a better proteasome inhibitor based on the Endeavor trial, that the potency increases, so do the class effect, so do the cardiotoxicity increases. It is not very uncommon to see cardiotoxicity. Appropriate monitoring is what is of extreme crucial importance. So the way that I always put this together is to identify, evaluate those risk factors, whether the patient has pre-existing cardiac disease, whether the patient has any systolic heart failure, prior history of MIs, any advanced valvular diseases. All these certainly will help us to identify those patients who are at risk for developing cardiac complications. Appropriate monitoring of blood pressure. Is the blood pressure getting uncontrolled? Appropriately starting antihypertensive regimen, and checking the blood pressures before and after carfilzomib administration. And if the systolic blood pressure is greater than 20 mm of mercury, the carfilzomib dose can be withheld if the disease permits it. And using appropriate dose reductions will certainly help mitigate all these symptoms. So what you see with the infusion timings for a 27 mg/m² is a 10-minute requirement of a infusion of carfilzomib. But what we had seen practically is if you prolong this infusion time to 30 minutes instead of giving it over 10 minutes, you mitigate a lot of these side effects that you normally see. And appropriately monitoring the patients and having a counseling with them, saying that they can anticipate these non-cardiac, non-pulmonary dyspnea as a complication of receiving carfilzomib, they certainly will be prepared to have a side effect similar, and there is no long-term toxicity that was seen with this side effect of dyspnea. And in our institution, we certainly take the help of a cardio oncologist, and certainly their input is of extreme importance, especially when managing the hypertension and the cardiac failure. So coming to a completely new set of agents, the monoclonal antibodies, the two drugs that fall into this category are the elotuzumab and daratumumab. The ELOQUENT 2 trial, which evaluated the benefit of combination of elotuzumab and lenalidomide dexamethasone versus lenalidomide dexamethasone, ELOQUENT 2 trial is the one that had shown that this drug can be safely administered even among relapsed refractory patients without much change in the toxicity profile. If you see any grade toxicities, they're almost similar to what you see with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, and the fatigue of 47% that was seen with elotuzumab, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, any grade is the most common side effect that you see with this combination. Similarly, with lenalidomide, dexamethasone, you see a 39% all any grade toxicity with fatigue. What you also see is lymphopenia, which was greater than grade 3 lymphopenia was significantly higher with elotuzumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone compared to lenalidomide and dexamethasone. But otherwise, the side effect profile across the board does not appear to be any different between lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and elotuzumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. What you commonly see is the infusion-related reactions with elotuzumab. It's a common theme for any monoclonal antibodies. And what has shown in our practice to mitigate these side effects are to give appropriate pre-medications with steroids, and certainly this will decrease the rates of the infusion-related reactions. The other drug is the daratumumab, which is a CD38 monoclonal antibody that was recently approved in November of 2015 as a single agent. And recently, it was approved in combination with bortezomib and in combination with lenalidomide based on the CASTOR and POLLUX trials. This is data based on the trial combining daratumumab, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone, showing that the infusion-related reactions are the most common ones that you can see, seen in half of the patients. And what's more striking is, if you look at the grade 3 toxicities, there are only 6% grade 3 toxicities in terms of the infusion-related reactions. Again, going on with the appropriate pre-medications, going on with a stable, steady increase in the infusion rates certainly can help counter these problems of infusion-related reactions. One important point is daratumumab certainly causes myelosuppression. When you're combining it with another agent that could cause myelosuppression, it is of extreme importance to identify which of these combinations that you could give and which of these combinations that you should give with a dose reduction. So one example is daratumumab in combination with pomalidomide and dexamethasone. In our practice, what we commonly do is use pomalidomide at 3 milligram at a starting dose when you combine with daratumumab. If the patient does not have any side effects, we go for 4 milligrams at the next setting. So again, from the DARA-POM-DEX trial, we saw that the infusion-related reactions are more common. So another beautiful abstract that was presented at ASH of this year was using montelukast to reduce the infusion-related reactions. This was presented by Dr. Chari from Mount Sinai, basically showing that the first infusion times have significantly decreased by using montelukast as a pre-medication along with the steroids. So this is very good by giving the pre-medication, you're reducing the time of the first infusion and reducing the infusion-related reactions. So the take-home points are: it is of extreme importance to obtain the optimal outcomes by giving uninterrupted delivery of these therapies. So how can we achieve this? Is by identifying the adverse events associated with each of these specific drugs, and making appropriate dose reductions and discontinuations whenever necessary to achieve, will help us to achieve this goal of this giving this drug continuously. Also, recognizing the patients, recognizing the at-risk patients for developing peripheral neuropathy or developing any cardiotoxicity will help us to choose the antimyelin agents that are very safe and specific for that patient population. And dose reduction strategies should be employed rigorously. Again, it is of crucial importance to identify the agents that cause infusion-related reactions, most commonly antibodies, and to have an upfront management strategy by giving pre-medication with steroids, by pre-medicating with montelukast, and also having an appropriate strategy of what should be done when such a reaction happens will certainly help us to mitigate these toxicities. Thank you.